Okay. Any comments or questions about anything we talked about this morning so far? Everybody back? Good.
Yes.
All right. Well, this is our literature section, and as a sign, we're doing Old Pictures in Florence, a poem by Robert Browning. And this is a poem Rose discovered a few months ago when she came upon a reference to it while reading Alice Bailey. And so the picture on the screen right now is Florence. It's, in fact, Browning refers to the bell tower in the second stanza was the startling bell tower Giotto raised, starts before that, the most appraised and the best to see was the startling bell tower Giotto raised, but why did it more than startle me? Well, there it is, right here on the left side of the picture, that squarish bell tower next to the cathedral in front of the Duomo, the dome. This is the bell tower that Giotto designed and raised, right there in living color. Giotto lived, 800 years ago. The bell tower was only partly finished when he died, but it has since been completed. But this is his design. So that gives you something of a reference point in terms of understanding this. So, who would like to sum up the meaning and impact of this poem, Old Pictures in Florence? I'm sorry? Yeah.
I just commented on the frivolous design.
Okay, well, that's fine, except that the dome is not mentioned in the poem.
I guess.
Okay, so comments summing up the poem. Anybody? Come on, all you frustrated English majors, let's go. Not going to let Robert Browning overwhelm you here, are you? Well, what are the old pictures? It's titled Old Pictures in Florence. What are the old pictures? Well, what paintings? Well, is he walking through, or does he live there, or what's the deal?
I thought he was living there, if I read.
Okay. Anybody else? This is a Giotto. In fact, this is a... Does anybody recognize what this Giotto is all about? This has nothing to do with the poem, but I'm giving you some examples of old paintings by Giotto, since he's the hero of the poem.
Can everyone see
Paul's
screen? All I see is black.
I can see it. Maybe your thing is timed up. Rub your mouth, see if it comes up.
We're trying to bring it up, too.
That's good. that's not the problem. I can see everything on my monitor except for Carl's screen, which is totally black.
Really?
Now viewing Carl's screen. Love it.
Can you try hitting the refresh under view?
Does Betty see it?
Yeah, that might help. I can see the pictures just fine.
Anybody other than Donna having a problem? Now, if you go to the top line of your computer, there should be something like view or whatever, and it should say refresh this page or something. I don't know. Do you have a Mac or an IBM?
I have a Mac.
Oh, okay, well then, if you, that's weird. If you go to Finder, and then over, next to Finder is File, and then Edit, and then View. If you go down View, you can do, oh, doesn't have Refresh. Sorry about that. Okay, try hitting the space bar. That's fine. Go ahead. All right. For those, does anybody recognize this painting? Japta did a series of paintings about St. Francis. This is a painting that portrays St. Francis confronting his father. And his father was a very wealthy wine merchant. And Francis lived a life of a young gentleman. And Francis's father berated him in the public square for not paying more attention to the family business and so on. And Francis stripped down bare naked, wasn't quite there yet in this painting, and gave his father back all of his clothes and said, "There you have everything I owe you. From now on, my father is my father in heaven." He did this in front of the bishop right here behind him.
Yeah, actually he was bare naked. It was the bishop who put the cloak around
right,
him.
Right, okay. He was bare naked. The bishop put the cloak around him, which is what Rose is just correcting me. And this is one of the great instances in human civilization, and I never heard about it in school. It was only in the last couple of years that I learned about this episode in the life of St. Francis, where he's renouncing the wealth of his mundane father and embracing the abundance of his heavenly father. It's a great scene. This should be a piece of art that is taught and widely recognized. Here's another one. Another Giotto. Donna, are you having any better luck?
Yep.
Good.
Did you try just hitting your space bar?
She's back in and she's fine now.
But ours goes black from time to time, and I just hit the space bar and it comes back.
Okay, good. This is a painting. I think it's called Justice. This is the goddess of justice. A painting by Giotto. These are the old pictures of Florence, many of them frescoes inside of churches, which is why they're decaying and falling apart, according to Browning. And of course, that was 150 years ago. And
it's almost like an old triptych.
Yes, it's part of a triptych, I think.
Yeah.
And so
but
here.
The one that you showed before. About him standing in front of his father.
Right.
That's what he did in St. Francis' tomb. And it's a series of works on the life of St. Francis.
Right.
By Giotto.
You're right.
Around it. It's magnificent.
Here's another one from that series, which I'm putting up. And this is where he receives the stigmata from whatever angel he received the stigmata from. And
stigmata angel.
Yeah, the stigmata angel. The angel came by and said, "Stig this." Okay, so what are the old pictures, and why Florence and why Giotto? Anybody? Did anybody understand the poem?
Well, part of it is his concern about the paintings deteriorating.
Is he concerned about the paintings deteriorating, or is that just a symbol of his concern for the deterioration of humanity's interest in Giotto?
The matter, definitely, yes.
Okay. And how is it, in the stanza 3, he says, "Giotto, how, with that soul of yours, could you play me false who loved you so? Some slights, if a certain heart endures, yet it feels, I would have your fellows know. In faith, I perceive not why I should care to break his silence that suits them best. But the thing grows somewhat hard to bear when I find that Giotto joined the rest." What's he talking about here?
Forgetting the inspiration of
Giotto? Yeah, I think so. And can anybody comment on the place Giotto has in the history of painting? I'm sorry? Okay. All right.
Carl?
Yes.
I think one of the distinctions there is that maybe whether they can be philosophers, painters, architects, sculptors, and be moving back and forth between all fields. And I got caught in American education when basically, the Bauhaus took hold, and when the socialism took hold in the early 30s. And so we now are kind of producing. I also was in a fine arts, and several times a fine arts environment, where you study painting and drawing, and that is a greater than even doing architecture. So, but that has been really replaced, gradually displaced. A much strong movement was the Beaux-Arts movement in France. It was strong through the first part of the 20th century.
Okay, but Browning wrote this poem in 1850 or 60. So that was before the Bauhaus. It was before, I mean, everything you're saying is true and accurate, but
I think he foresaw it.
Well, that would be an interpretation. Fine.
Well, when did Marx write his stuff?
Well, Marx would have.
Well, philosophically, you trace it back to this period.
Okay.
He was witnessing a change in the arts and
experience. All right. Well, let's try to understand what's going on in the poem. What?
I thought you were still on Giotto.
I am. The poem's about Giotto.
He's like the forerunner of the Renaissance, in that he made the holy figures human and put them in a more realistic, human-like setting, and also created a mold and the halos that was sort of his perception, so I think
he's
probably very psychic as well.
Okay. So, why is Browning writing about the life of Giotto? Giotto is, that's quite correct, Giotto lived in the 14th century, died in the early 1300s, about 200 years before the Renaissance really kicked in, but he's considered the father of the Renaissance, pre-Renaissance.
Well, obviously, he was inspired by him. He was uplifted by, you know, we were talking about literature before. This is the same idea in art.
Okay. But then why is Browning writing a poem about old pictures in Florence?
I think he's asking, too, do the people of that day see the meaning, what these art meant, or that is there a carryover of the essence of his art? Do people see it?
Okay. Well, I think you've got a legitimate point there. I think it's more of a case of what have we done that Giotto is forgotten until you go to Florence and you see this startling bell tower and realize that that was created by him, even though it wasn't finished till after his lifetime. And all these paintings throughout Italy. Let me read you the fourth stanza. On the arch where olives overhead print the blue sky with twig and leaf, that sharp curled leaf which they never shed, twixt the aloes I used to lean in chief and mark through the winter afternoon by a gift God grants me now and then, in the mild decline of those suns like moons who walked in Florence beside her men. What's he talking about there? Okay, what is the line by a gift God grants me now and then mean? Okay. Anybody else?
Well, is he talking about great men, as in the other story we read, the essay by Emerson?
Well, he's talking about great men, and in many senses there are parallels between this and that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who else? By a gift God grants me now and then, in the mild decline of those suns like moons, who walked in Florence beside her men. All right. There's perhaps even a hint that maybe he was Giotto. Ah. Now, I'm not saying that that's something that you can nail down and prove conclusively, but there's a hint there that he walked with these men in Florence, these great painters. And if he wasn't Giotto, maybe he knew Giotto. And
he's having a far memory.
Yeah, there's almost a sense of personal chagrin to see the old pictures in Florence decay, not just on the walls of the churches, but in the hearts and minds of men. Wherever, stanza six, wherever a fresco peels and drops, wherever an outline weakens and wanes, till the latest life in the painting stops, stands one whom each fainter pulse tick pains, one wishful each scrap should clutch the brick, each tinge not wholly escape the plaster, a lion who dies in an ass's kick, the wronged great soul of an ancient master. I love that line, the wronged great soul of an ancient master. We're not taking care of the divine legacies, the inspirations that have been granted to us. And he goes on, for oh, this world and the wrong it does, they are safe in heaven with their backs to it. The Michaels and Raphaels, you hum and buzz around the works of you, you and the little wit. Do their eyes contract to the earth's old scope, now that they see God face to face, and have all attained to the poets, I hope, till 'tis their holiday now in any case. And he goes on like this.
Well, how about the line down here where he says, not dreaming that the old and new are fellows?
Yeah.
I mean, that could be the reference you made of maybe he was.
Yes, exactly. Old masters this and early the other, not dreaming that old and new are fellows. A younger succeeds to an elder brother, Da Vinci derived in good time from Delos. So it is not the work of Giotto that troubles him. It is the fact that we think his genius is decaying and fading. We lose track of the fact that the Renaissance and the pre-Renaissance was a brilliant explosion of the mind of God in human life. And it should be respected as such. We look at the picture and fail to see the inspiration above the mean. Giotto was the precursor of the Renaissance, the first modern artist, as we said, yet his influence on modern man has dimmed, and Browning is disheartened by it. I want to read a number of stanzas here, and hopefully this... Go ahead.
The public school of Papa did study Giotto of the separation of church and state.
Well, that's why we are forming Walden Grove to be unfettered by such silliness. Okay, let's read stanzas. Yes. Yes.
Maybe one or two masters of historic architecture, and that was it. And it was all to a new modern experience that you know, we witness all around us today, which lacks that kind of depth of understanding. But it was, I think it's important to understand that this was deliberately cut out of the school.
Oh, absolutely. In every field. Okay, stanzas 11 and 12 I want to read. If you knew their work, you would deal your dole. May I take upon me to instruct you. When Greek art ran and reached the goal, thus much had the world to boast in fructu. The truth of man as by God first spoken, which the actual generations garble, was re-uttered, and soul, which limbs betoken, and limbs, soul and forms, made new in marble. So you saw yourself as you wished you were, as you might have been, as you cannot be. Earth here rebuked by Olympus there, and grew content in your poor degree with your little power by those statues' godhead, and your little scope by their eyes' full sway, and your little grace by their grace embodied, and your little date by their forms that stay. The treasures of civilization reveal what we need to know about God and man. Even the small amount that Giotto, and he may be talking about himself or may not be, but he certainly identifies with this, the small amount of inspiration that it takes to make a great artist like Giotto is still just a role model for what every one of us should attain. St. Francis was the model for what we should all adopt as our approach to the divine.
Infructu,
it's Latin for fruitfulness, productivity.
The process of ministry.
Yeah. Okay, let me read stanza 14. So testing your weakness by their strength, your meager charms by their rounded beauty, measured by art in your breadth and length, you learned to submit as a mortal's duty. When I say you, 'tis the common soul, the collective, I mean the race of man, that receives life in parts to live in a whole and grow here according to God's clear plan. What a marvelous stanza. It's easy, it's easy to understand, it's direct. He's not talking about Giotto. He's talking about the ordinary person viewing Giotto and discovering his weakness by Giotto's strength. Our meager charms by the rounded beauty of art, measured by art in your breadth and length, you learn to submit is a mortal's duty. It's a reminiscent of the essay on man, submit, content to be as blessed as thou canst bear. You, when I say you, 'tis the common soul, the collective, I mean the race of man, that receives life in parts to live in a whole. How reminiscent of that is the from the essay on man, the vast chain of being from God to man, and grow here according to God's clear plan. Art is supposed to reveal this. And the study of art should be geared to reveal this. So as difficult as this poem may seem upon first reading, after you read it three or four times, it starts to get a little bit easier. But he's setting down a marker here for understanding the incredible treasures of art, music, literature that we've inherited from previous generations. And that's just in terms of European art and so on. Since Browning's time, we've been enriched by Oriental, Indian, Chinese, etc., Japanese culture. The treasures that have been bequeathed to us physically and mentally are stunning.
And now we have the internet, and we can actually see what maybe we would have never had an opportunity to see.
Right, unless it's gone black on you. But, okay, let me go on a little bit more and read stanzas 19 and 20, on which I conclude that the early painters, to cries of Greek art and what more with you, replied, to become now self-acquainters and paint man, whatever the issue. Make new hope shine through the flesh they fray, new fears aggrandize the rags and tatters to bring the invisible full into play. Let the visible go to the dogs, what matters? A great line. He's being colloquial here, but to bring the invisible full into play, let the visible go to the dogs, what matters? And so this is one of the great steps forward in art of Giotto's time and the Renaissance, is it brought the invisible. Any art form, any art work that brings the invisible full into play through the visible is part of the grand process of inspiration and creativity. Then we come down, skip one stanza and read 21 and 22. There's a fancy some lean to and others hate, that when this life is ended, begins new work for the soul in another state, where it strives and gets weary, loses and wins, where the strong and the weak, this world conjured, repeat and enlarge what they practiced in small, through life after life in unlimited series, only the scales to be changed, that's all. Yet I hardly know, when a soul has seen by the means of evil that good is best, and through earth and its noise what is heaven serene, when our faith is the same, in the same has stood the test, Why the child grown man, you burn the rod. The uses of labor are surely done. There remaineth a rest for the people of God, and I have had troubles enough for one. Okay, so what's he saying here?
He's talking about the incarnation, I guess.
Well, he's certainly talking about the extension of life beyond death.
Mm-hmm.
That when this life is ended, begins new work for the soul in another state. That could be reincarnation. But it simply, it certainly is the continuity of life. Where it strives and gets weary, loses and wins, where the strong and the weak, this world's congeries repeat in large what they practiced in small. Through life after life in unlimited series, only the scales to be changed, that's all. Yet I hardly know when a soul has seen by the nature of evil that good is best. That's the line that DK quoted. And this is a line that we should etch in our memories and souls. When a soul has seen by the means of evil that good is best. And through earth and its noise, what is heaven serene, when our faith in the same has stood the test, the child-grown man, you burn the rod, you become a man, you leave behind childish sins. The uses of labor are surely done, there remaineth a rest for the people of God, and I have had troubles enough for one. Art lifts us up. Art, it is true, not everybody can look at the paintings of Giotto and see its inherent inspiration and the presence of the divine. As we see in stanza 21, there's a fancy some lean to and others hate. There's a division in human thinking that life ends with death or life continues on. That's the basic battleground in the realm of art and the realm of all literature and artwork, study, learning, civilization. Is art supposed to reveal the inner, or is it supposed to chronicle the problems of the outer? Only the scales to be changed, that's all. And then we come to the end and unfortunately, I didn't have time to read everything, but the last four stanzas or so, or last three stanzas here, are brilliant. Then one shall propose in a speech, curt Tuscan, expurgate and sober, with scarcely an issimo, to end now our half-told tale of Cambuscan, and turn the bell towers alt to altissimo, and fine as the beak of a young Beccaccia, the campanile, the Duomo's fit ally, shall soar up in gold full 50 braccia, completing Florence as Florence, Italy. Shall I be alive that morning, the scaffold is broken away, and the long-pent fire, like the golden hope of the world unbaffled, springs from its sleep and up goes the spire, while God and the people claim for its motto, thence the new tricolor flaps the sky, at least to foresee the glory of Giotto and Florence together, the first am I. I'm sorry, I should have read the previous stanza too. Stanza 34, I meant to start there. How shall we prologize, how shall we perorate, utter fit things upon art and history, feel truth at blood heat and falsehood at zero rate, make of the one of the age no mystery, contrast the fructuous and sterile eras, show monarchy over its uncouth cub, licks out of the bear's shape into chimeras, while pure art's birth is still the republic. So he's ending this with an analogy that art precedes history, that the great breakthroughs of Giotto and other old masters set the way for people to start to see that monarchy and similar systems are inadequate for bringing heaven to earth, and that it's the Republic. This is the meaning of the line in stanza 35, completing Florence as Florence, Italy. Florence as a city-state was detached from the rest of Italy. And the contributions that Giotto made are made even richer by the emergence of a republic and a democracy in Italy. So he's talking about the whole sweep of human evolution and human until the human individual, the average common soul, is able to educate themselves and see the power of these rich treasures, they're not able to rule themselves. But once they are benefited by these for several hundred years, the spark of freedom and self-reliance takes hold in their consciousness, and they're able to fulfill the prophecy of the old pictures in form. Okay, some comments, some additional insights on old pictures in form. Right. Good. Other insights, questions, comments?
You, Carl?
Yes, Bill.
Started in the 20s of this rejection of God and spirit. And I was exposed to it, and you know, it is very captivating, and it's very difficult to break loose from that. So I would say, you know, the broader audience are trying to reach with Wald and Grove. For example, the parents are picking kids for the school, and they're probably, or even the grandparents who are funding the schools for their grandchildren, are from my generation, which is a little bit earlier than yours. But it's hard, and I've tried back to my own career to see how it started. It started in your remark on Howell's comment in the early turn of the century was. And so, the images present what a real tough job, a very important job, and not know how to really make that start again like that. It's probably more difficult than we really realize.
Well, it's both more difficult and it's less difficult. It's more difficult from the point of view beneath the mean. More difficult, we realize how staggering the cards are stacked against us. But it's not difficult at all when you look at it from above the mean, because that's what's going to be nurtured. That's what's going to be nourished. Again, the key line in this whole poem is the line that I read,
when a soul has...
Yeah, when a soul has seen by the means of evil that good is best. We need the evil of the intellectual doubt, the cynicism, the pessimism. We need that evil in order to wake us up and say, my God, we're in danger of losing what we treasure unless we do something. Can you imagine what would happen to this country if there had been no Obama, no Clinton, none of the left for the last 50 years? There would be no reason for the right to rise up in indignation and try to do something better. We learn what is good by confronting evil. And every artist that does anything that speaks down through the ages learns to paint the good by confronting the imperfect in their own hearts, their own minds, their own souls. And so this is a tremendous insight that we, in order to serve our ideals, we have to be willing to confront evil, and we triumph over it. We neutralize it. We don't eliminate it, but we put it, we make it a lesson for others to learn by. Good. Very good. Good commentary and discussion here. Let's, it's time for our next session. We must go about the next session here, the next period. And, of course, I'll leave some of this up on the screen, but it doesn't apply to what we're talking about now. But I like the picture of the bell tower and the dome. This period, of course, is given over to the discussion of the Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle. And we come now to a point in our reading where we can see how ethics evolve and adapt. In each case, there's a first principle, which was enunciated by Plato or Socrates or Parmenides before them. But this is something the average person does not apprehend. Aristotle recognizes that the average person could care less about justice as a first principle. What they want is vengeance. So he approximates it as best as he can, either embracing it or rejecting it. In thinking of friendship, for example, he may erroneously conclude that it is, and I'm talking about the average person now, not Aristotle, thinking about friendship, we might erroneously conclude that it's good to have friends because you can manipulate them to do your bidding. They owe you something, and so you can take advantage of that. So the average person adopts this as an ethos and lives his life accordingly until life rubs his face in his error and proves to him that he is manipulating himself far more than others and exposing himself to be exploited by others. And the line, we learn to grow by discovering that evil produces what is good, out of evil comes good, is very consistent with this. Aristotle then, or the average person then, discards manipulation and moves to the opposite extreme, where he enslaves himself to the bond of friendship with those he cares. Eventually, experience shows him what a disaster that is, and he moves back in the other direction again. If he had studied the first principle in his application, he could have eliminated most of this vacillating back and forth from being manipulative to being a wallflower. But not being taught the science of ethics, he struggles on in darkness, back and forth, heading slowly toward the golden mean, but never quite reaching it for eons and eons. Aristotle devotes most of his treatise to examining the way in which the golden mean is reached for a number of ethical pairs of opposites. And so, for example, he talks about courage, which develops out of a conflict between fear and confidence. And he describes, he evaluates temperance, which emerges out of the conflict between pleasure and pain, as we learn to temper our character. That's what temperament is, by the way. Temperament is that which we temper. And you can have a pleasing temperament or a hideous temperament. Generosity is produced by the conflict between helpfulness and greed. Magnificent, I'm very much condensing about six books here. Magnificence is arising from the conflict between the sublime and vulgarity. Greatness is an ethic arising from the conflict between nobility and vanity, or honor and disgrace. Ambition arises from desire on the one hand and passive acceptance. These are the pairs of opposites that interact over 40, 50 lifetimes, maybe 100, until you refine the ethic that can guide you correctly. And again, you can short-circuit this process by simply studying the first principle, i.e. reading Love Virtue, or anything else that sets them forth and helps you understand. But even then, it takes a while of studying to understand what compassion really is. So we have gentleness arising from compassion on the one hand and anger and irritability on the other. And yet we can see that the left has adopted the word compassion as their hue and cry, and yet none of their programs are compassionate. They enslave. They make dependent. So they're talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk. It's hypocrisy. They claim to be acting with compassion, and they're doing exactly the opposite. This is the give and take, the flow of the pendulum from the one pole of compassion or seeming compassion to the opposite pole of anger and condemnation. And out of that eventually arises gentleness. Friendship, the value, the ethic of friendship arises out of affection on the one hand and hate on the other. Honesty arises out of the interaction of truthfulness and deception. Charm emerges from grace and boorishness. Back and forth, back and forth. Now, he also writes of other ethics, which we'll talk about some on Thursday, the intellectual ethics, such as justice, which are we don't discover so much from physical experience as we do from intellectual pondering and the attempt to define it. So let's read above the lines and think of Aristotle's ideal of the golden mean as the perfect balance between these extremes, allowing us to wend our way in the noble middle path. If we can make this assumption, we can unlock a whole new dimension to his thinking, which is there but not spelled out so much. Here's my idea. If we smother a friend with excessive affection, or a parent smothers a child with too much affection, we throw the relationship out of balance. Affection is good, but too much affection can smother and cripple self-reliance. the typical type of parent that gives the child everything they want, and they have all these expensive toys but no love. This in turn throws everything out of balance and puts us on the defensive, setting us up for disappointment. The cure is not to start expressing affection so much as to learn to express affection so that it enriches the bond rather than overwhelms it. The problem is not in the affection. It's in our indiscriminate use of affection. And we, the cliche of the man who puts his love interest on a pedestal and worships her. That's too much affection, the wrong kind of affection. It's a cloying, demeaning kind of affection, which creates an imbalance that has to be corrected. Or the classic example of a Catholic, a good Catholic, who grows up loving the church and everything the church stands for, but then becomes disappointed when he or she learns that the church is fallible, that the Pope can make mistakes, that the church can do horrible things like the Inquisition. And then, you see, they have a dilemma. You renounce the church? Well, most people do. But renouncing the church doesn't produce balance. How can it? In fact, it violates our ethos. So we must put the fallibility of the church into its proper perspective, based on our ethics. So let's see how, if you combine the idea of balance with the golden mean, then this becomes an active working tool for resolving the problems of ethics. So let's go back to some of these ones that I mentioned briefly in passing. And talk about these things case by case. He states that courage is a ethic that is developed out of the conflict between fear and confidence. How can we use that idea to balance our life, specifically to deal with fears?
Well, recognizing that fear pushes life away from us. It paralyzes you. It pushes life away.
Okay, well, how is that in balance? What is the balancing factor?
Love, self-determination.
All right. Love is the opposite of fear. Mm-hmm. He defines it as a conflict between fear and confidence. Confidence really is no more valuable than fear is, unless it's based in courage, the confidence of courage.
But your determination not to let fear paralyze you.
Okay. So one has to divorce oneself. See, there's this whole ethic that we've run into. I'm sure everybody else has run into it. Some people believe that all of life is a fear-based system. So if you have reached a conclusion that everybody responds to life based on their fears, and that fear is good because it protects you, then how do you ever develop courage? Anybody? This is not a private conversation. Feel free to leap in anytime.
Well, in our Thinking Out Loud group, there were people who were determined to hang on to their fear.
Right.
You needed fear because, I mean, if a bear came at you in the woods, you needed the fear to run away from it, or I don't know what they thought, but...
Actually, the example was if a bear ran into the building that we were in,
yeah,
we would need fear to protect ourselves. Yeah. And yet fear would probably paralyze us and the bear could have its way with us. What we need is courage, the strength of heart to... What we need is the ability of the master to go over and calm the bear down and say...
They're there.
They're there, bear. Nice to see you. Anybody else? What it that needs a little bit of clarification. It's loving what you've already been given but have not yet developed. Okay, anybody else? Go ahead, Dorothy.
I think more one works in developing their potential to minimize fear and really create more confidence and so on, then the more your paradigm shifts that you can tap into that potential in others as well. So you're not looking at things as, responding. You need to respond to fear, respond with fear in life. You change your paradigm.
Well, that's absolutely true, and it brings up an interesting point, and that is that fear is purely an emotional reaction. The soul does not experience fear. How can it experience fear? It knows it's immortal, that there's continuity of life. If the life of the personality ends, well, so be it. It will just return to its source and recognize its bond with the soul more clearly. So what's the fear? Fear is entirely an emotional response that paralyzes our capacity to think. A fear-based system is by definition superstitious. We give the people who oppose us powers and abilities that they don't possess. And then we quaver and quail and say, oh, we're paralyzed. We can't do anything about this. And we've defeated ourselves. Fear is self-defeating. Courage derives from the heart. And it's the strength of the soul. So it's not just a question of pretending to be strong. It's a system of tapping that strength. Anybody else? Well, I like this list here that he's got. He's got magnificence arising out of the conflict between the sublime and the vulgar. You don't usually think of magnificence as an ethos, as an ethic. I do, but humanity doesn't all that much. So what is the conflict between the sublime and the vulgar, and how does the golden mean of magnificence embrace a first principle? Anybody? Well, what is magnificence?
The glory of God.
Okay, that would be one definition, the glory of God and God's creation. That would imply that we become magnificent as we discover that glory alive and well within our being. But then there's that temptation between vulgarity and sublimity. So what is magnificence? Anybody?
Well, it helps us magnify the sublime.
There you go. The key word in magnificence is
magnify.
Magnify is what magnifies. It's what we take into our heart and magnify. Now, some people, the Marquis de Sade's of the world, magnify vulgarity and until they become totally destroyed by it. If you magnify sublimity, sublimity is what you look for above the mean, the sublime, the inner essence. The more you magnify that, the more it tends to dominate your character. And so the determination to magnify the best within it, anything, to bless other people through magnifying the best within them, to bless the situation. How can we use the ethic of magnificence in dealing with our current political situation? Anybody? Are the youth of Great Britain expressing magnificence in response to the austerity measures being implemented in that country? Are the youth of Greece expressing magnificence in their response to austerity measures?
So we need to magnify at least within ourselves and however we can influence our own sphere and help that in mass consciousness, we need to magnify and lift up the best within ourselves, but to think clearly about these issues when everybody else is stampeding and being hysterical, we need to remain calm and sure in our principles and values. And to the degree that each person does that, we are contributing that to mass consciousness. We're contributing that to our sphere of influence.
Okay, I think you've just touched a key point, and that is that, in essence, magnificence is like the Titan's cup. And as we build and expand and magnify the best within our own awareness, it spills out and it radiates through mass consciousness and encourages the growth of the sublime, not the vulgar. Okay? Any other comments?
I had an image of a diamond. I was looking at my ring, and the brilliant is the magnificent and the little cutting is reflecting light, and together it makes it magnificent and brilliant. And I think in our country, or even with youth, going back to self-reliance, you know, if every individual lives up to his or her potential, you know, it magnifies the nation, purpose of the nation. So.
Okay. As each individual strengthens his or her bond with the spirit of that nation, they move in the direction of magnificence. Now, again, to go back to my question, is the acts of the youth in Great Britain, do these acts lead to magnificence or do they lead to vulgarity or chaos?
I didn't think you really wanted an answer to that question.
You were saying earlier that it is through the actions that are negative politically in this country or other countries that it's because of our response that it can become magnificent. But it certainly, what needs to go through the vulgar state first for us to respond.
Okay.
With the youth, I mean, if they don't have the modeling, because they are youth, to have the time or the ability to see through the evil, you know, to lead to the good, if they don't have leadership, I mean, I live in our country now, and there are so many young people who, whatever Obama says is true, they don't have the ability yet to see through that.
I think they're developing it fairly rapidly.
It's not just young people.
Yeah.
It's not just young people.
The question was youth. That's how I was thinking of.
Well, no, the question was youth in Great Britain, not in this country so much. I say that because the youth in Great Britain are rioting, three days of rioting now, torching cars and burning buildings. And they do have leadership. Unfortunately, it's a very vulgar kind of leadership, but who is behind it? It's the troublemakers, it's the community agitators, it's the unions. They do have leadership, just like in the Arab Spring, so-called, those... That's right. That's right. It leads to a rather vulgar display of putting Mubarak on trial. And this completely obscures the potential of magnificence in Egypt. Egypt has, for 50, 60, 70 years, been on the road to once again becoming a legitimate partner in civilization, and now they've taken a huge step backwards.
So then the youth are, to go back to the poem, they're still at the stage of evil.
Right.
When a soul has seen by the means of evil that good is best, they haven't discovered that yet. They're still working with the vulgar, with the evil.
Right. With the forces that diminish rather than magnify.
Mm-hmm.
So again, to put it in terms of our country, what are the forces that magnify and what are the forces that diminish? Yeah. Speak up a little bit, please.
Right. Well, anyway, I have looked up the roots of magnets, which is great, and then it seems to me that some of the Tea Party rivers are guiding us. They're taking us back to the greatness, which was the principles that the country was founded on. And their actions and what they're doing are based on that. So I'm thinking that we're on the path in a lot of ways. And some of the things that are happening may give us the opportunity. Show what we can do.
Okay, but in that context, what specifically are we to magnify?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. The principles on which we were.
Which are?
Freedom of beings, freedom of mind. That's two big things right there.
What's that? Rose mentioned brotherhood. I would define it as goodwill. Exactly. So what does it mean to magnify goodwill or freedom in this context?
I was going back to you asked what was sublime and what was the vulgar in this country.
Right.
So if you use the triangle, the one baseline would be we the people, and the other one would be the hate America crowd, and at the apex would be the spirit of America.
Okay.
Trying to magnify its plan so that we all can respond to it.
Okay, that's an interesting concept or an interesting diagram because... as the spirit of America flows down both
sides,
it magnifies the hate America crowd as much as it magnifies the love America crowd.
Right.
Okay, so we have to be willing to allow that, but not let it get out of control or out of let it overwhelm us.
But then, as we express goodwill, that would draw the two sides.
Well, it might.
It should. It hopefully would draw.
The important thing is, again, to maintain. Go back to the purpose of this exercise, and that is that Aristotle suggests that because of this, we achieve the ethic by balancing. We put everything in terms of how is this out of balance, how is it balanced. And so in terms of our society today, we have to conclude that the forces that love the spirit of America have allowed the little vixens of the field, the rodents of the whatever that the Christ talks about, to enter into our culture and reduce it. What Bill was talking about of the corruption of thinking in our schools and whatnot that teach anti-human kinds of concepts, that God is dead, that God has no place in our schools, and our society has been bombarded by this assault, and we need to cultivate the love of the greatness of America to balance this out.
So our lack of vigilance or our protecting that which we cherish,
right.
We just got lazy and thought it could take care of itself.
Right, and now we need to steer the ship of state back through the rough waters. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I'm interested in, you know, we're talking about art more, and a few weeks ago I watched a video on like sculpture. I think David, Rodin, these magnificent pieces of art were right there for everyday man to look at and think about. Shakespeare, people went to these plays. In our country, we have symbols like, let's say, our flag. Schools today, we give kids a choice. We want to put it in a flag. You know, are we holding reverence the symbols of America? You know, the question of division of the church and state and all this. So we're like going in the opposite direction rather than holding up and having right there for people right in our head. We're giving kids options and in false direction.
Right. Now, why do we do that?
Yeah, why?
Political correctness.
Well, there's a sense of political correctness, but you see, this is all in the name of freedom.
Communism is a step away from God.
Well, that's true, but how is it defended? It's defended on the basis that, well, the child should be free to choose whether to say the Pledge of Allegiance or not. It's a false definition of freedom. So let's put this in terms of
guidance and say we elders are directing you, how to live your life, and how you can live up to this goal of our country, not who you want to.
Right. Well, but again, the conundrum is you can't force anybody to be free. You have to give them the opportunity and then allow them to choose. But they need to understand that every choice you make in which you have a chance to choose freedom, you also have a chance to choose enslavement. That freedom is the opposite of enslavement. So on the baseline of the ethic of freedom, there's freedom and there's enslavement. And people go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth between them until they learn balance. So what is the balanced measure of freedom in our society? That's probably what we lack right now. Anybody? I'm sorry? Well, I mean, discipline is certainly an element of it, but you can be repressed without being free, if we turn to a dictator, if we gave Obama dictatorial powers, you know, in a heartbeat, he would repress everybody that didn't agree with him with an iron fist.
Lucidity?
Okay, lucidity.
What about...
go ahead.
What about that we're lacking critical thinking because there's a false definition of freedom. So people are not thinking through what the true definition is.
Okay, and what is the true definition?
That... that we have a choice to have a choice. We don't have to choose enslavement.
Okay. Let's put this in terms of the individual.
But there are consequences in every choice we make.
All right, that's a good point. There are consequences in every choice we make. But even more to the point, does an individual citizen in this country have any freedom if any other citizen fails to have freedom?
No.
And why not? It's the society that must be free, not the individual. It's we the people that have inalienable rights. You can't have partial rights. You can't say, well, freedom of religion applies to one group but not to another group. We all enjoy freedom of religion. We all enjoy freedom of speech, or none of us do. So by its very definition, political correctness is an assault on freedom because it takes away freedom from some of the people. It's another way of approaching this is that FDR claimed that there was a right to be free from poverty and want, and so he established this idea of freedom from, and that distracts from understanding that the real freedom is the freedom to choose. We can be free from the cost of medical treatment by having national health care, but we're not necessarily free to choose whether we're going to get that health care or not.
Or the death penalty.
Or the death penalty, right. So that's a good example of the difference between freedom from and freedom to. If we define it in terms of freedom from health problems, the expense of health, we have to give up our freedom to choose how we're going to pursue health in order to get there. And that's a trade-off that the vast majority of people in this country do not want to take, do not want to make. And so freedom... the easiest definition of freedom is that freedom applies to every citizen in this country. It doesn't apply to people who aren't citizens in this country, but it applies to every citizen has to be free to choose, or nobody is free to choose. And this is the inconsistency of Congress and federal employees having one healthcare system, and everybody else getting a second-rate, poorer one. That's not freedom. That's enslavement. There's no two ways about it. Okay, we're running out of time here. I need to end the session. Hold on a second.